This is your tech news briefing for Thursday, October 22nd. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. We talked about the antitrust suit that the Justice Department launched against Google on Tuesday. The DOJ alleges that the company has paid huge amounts to effectively cut off competitors and used other anti-competitive tactics to protect its monopoly on search. Well, yesterday, we got a chance to hear what former chairman and CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, thought about all of that, when our senior personal tech columnist, Joanna Stern, spoke with him at our annual Tech Live conference.
I can say that we worked really hard to avoid any illegal activity. And I'm quite sure that there's no violations of law on the Google side. I'm sure there are things to complain about with respect to what Google does. We hear complaints all the time. I'm not there anymore. But as a matter of antitrust, I spent an awful lot of time on the other side of the Microsoft case in 1997. And so we worked very hard to not trip those wires. And I'm quite sure we did not.
We'll have Schmidt's full conversation with Joanna Stern coming up after the break.
So I want to start with just a little bit of news around a little company you used to run. What's your reaction been to the DOJ antitrust suit that was filed yesterday?
I may be the only person on this stage that is going to tell you that we should start by praising big tech. Can you imagine the pandemic without what Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, you name it, Microsoft have done for us, largely with free or subsidized products? I cannot imagine how miserable the pandemic would be without it. With respect to the DOJ lawsuit, I think the government should work on having a plan to fix the COVID problem. But given that they don't, and they're focused on Google, I can say that we worked really hard to avoid any illegal activity. And I'm quite sure that there's no violations of law on the Google side. I'm sure there are things to complain about with respect to what Google does. We hear complaints all the time. I'm not there anymore. But as a matter of antitrust, I spent an awful lot of time on the other side of the Microsoft case in 1997. And so we worked very hard to not trip those wires. And I'm quite sure we did not.
Yeah, I want to come back to your first statement in a moment. But I was going to ask you, while you were at Google, were there things you did or didn't do to avoid getting into regulatory crosshairs?
Well, there were many things that we didn't do. And the key thing, which is what the company's defense is now to these charges, is that you always have a choice. So the core thing with Microsoft in 1997 was that there was only one way to distribute apps on their Microsoft platform. And they were ordered, ultimately broken up, which was then reversed on appeal over the judges' issues, fundamentally because they were both the platform and the channel. Well, Google is essentially neither, right? In the sense that you have platform choices, but more importantly, in every case, you can switch from one vendor to another. And indeed, the company just yesterday published a demonstration of all of these abilities. So the frustration with Google must be over the size of its market share and the role it plays, but not as a matter of the exclusion of competition, which is what the legal issue is. We were very, very well aware of these issues, and I know because I drove it. I also was the person who did all the antitrust work with Europe for over 7 years. So we again, made sure we didn't cross those lines.
Well, I mean, there's so many points to unpack here, but I want to go back to your first about being the only person on stage that said big tech is good. I think tech is great. And certainly your point around us using tech through the pandemic, we wouldn't have gotten through it without a lot of these tools. But it does come back to, is there the ability for other companies to come along at this point and provide some of those tools and break into the race?
Well, in search, we point out, and I pointed out for 20 years, that there is a higher value, larger corporation with more cash and more employees, also known as Microsoft, which has a very competitive offering to Google Search called Bing. And I think what's missed in this dialogue is that people somehow think that these are unitary markets. The Amazon ad marketplace is of a similar scale to the Google numbers. I don't know the exact numbers anymore. And all of these big companies are ruthlessly competing with each other. So the answer to the critics is that the benefit of the Apple-Google competition over Android, for example, is that you have a true multi-generational supercomputer in your pocket at an incredibly subsidized price, right? Whether it's an Android platform or an iPhone platform.
You brought up Apple, so let's talk actually, because that seems to be some of the center part of this case, the fact that Google and Apple have a deal. The default search engine there is Google. When you struck that deal, did you expect at that time that this would be such a vital part of both of the businesses?
No, although Apple wanted certainly a lot of money for it. And so there was ultimately a deal that I did not personally negotiate, but it was a lucrative deal for Apple. But important to say that with respect to Google and with respect to use of Google search on Apple phones, it is extremely easy to switch to another provider. And indeed, the Google company has produced a video to show you exactly how to switch away from Google in case you should choose to do so.
So why don't more people do it?
Well, I would personally say that the Google product is better, but I'll let people decide. And remember that Google's market share is not 100%. Google has very strong competitors, especially in the United States. And so I would be careful about these sort of dominance arguments. I just don't agree with them. There's a difference between dominance and excellence.
Just looking at overall regulation, it seems like the companies have been able to do whatever they would like. Do you have any thought on what regulation could come in the United States that would tamp these companies in a way that would restrict some of it, but still allow them to grow and to be the companies that they are?
So let me remind you that Google is subject to a 20-year consent decree over a particular product that we did, whose name was Wave, I think, over access to private data. And all of the companies that I'm aware of are under various forms of agreement with the government of the United States over, shall we say, errors that they made or things which were judged ultimately incorrect. So it's not correct to say that they're unfettered. And furthermore, these companies are governed by U.S. law and they are heavily inspected by U.S. inspectors. So this is not a law-free zone. And so I've said for a long time that I think information is very powerful, and information and more of the information, as we become addicted, if you will, or reliant on the internet, more of that information will become regulated. The most obvious candidate for regulation are the excesses in the social networking space. A simple example is that we believe in free speech. I know you do, and I can assure you I do. But I'm not in favor of free speech for robots. And I think the concept of social networks, broadly speaking, serving as amplifiers for idiots and crazy people was not what we intended. I'm sure nobody did. And so I'm concerned, and I'll say it very clearly, that unless there are mechanisms invented to keep the discourse sort of reasonable, right, and not taken over, for example, by foreign interests, misinformation from Russia. There are a series of exposés on RT and the things that they're doing, which is essentially an operation representing the Russian government with respect to the news. There are plenty of examples of this. And it's not like a new concern. The U.S. government has expressed a great deal of concern about the impact of the Chinese government and TikTok. And so we should have this concern. And my guess is that unless the industry gets its act together in a really clever way, there will be further regulation in that area.
And I mean, that's just a quick follow-up on Section 230. I mean, you know, some of that's in that realm. I mean, what do you make of that? Do you think that's what needs to change?
I would be very careful about Section 230 because you have I think roughly 20% of the U.S. stock market is tied up in five companies and a number of others that are dependent on the ways those laws in basically 1995, 1996, 1997 were passed that allow for the operation of the internet as we know it. When you start attacking those bases, you have unintended secondary consequences. I still remember in 1997, we were having an argument over this, and the government had proposed that we outlaw caching. Caching is a local copy that's kept in the network. Well, that would break the internet. And I remember sitting there and saying, in a nice way, you idiots, you're going to break the internet. And we eventually got those changes. So be very careful about what appear to be simplistic answers to what are very powerful and complicated systems and balances of interest.
Got it. And just to go back to one partisan question, which seemed to be implied before, I mean, do you feel like this suit is sort of just a political move?
Well, I don't know. As I have read, I've not been involved with it, obviously, and I've not been briefed by Google, so I can't speak for them. It seems to me that the suit in its current form was largely driven by Republicans. And at the end of a term of a president whose polling indicates he's unlikely to be elected, we'll see. In any case, once the suit is filed, it survives the presidential transitions. And so these things tend to take about a decade. And all I can tell you is that it's bad public policy to use antitrust to regulate. You're better off trying to figure out what regulations you want, because you can actually pass them as laws through the political process and so forth. Antitrust is a very blunt instrument, and you can be sure that the corporation will defend itself, as all other corporations have. And I told you my personal opinion already about where the line was and the company hadn't crossed it. So we'll see what the process says. I just want to be clear that I'm not in any way speaking for the company. I've not been briefed. I'm not an employee. I'm not a board member. I am a large shareholder. I hope that that's very clear to everybody.
Definitely clear to me as just someone who, you know, ran the company for a couple years and helped it certainly grow. You are a Biden supporter. Do you feel like a Biden-Harris White House would be different for big tech?
It's hard to know. When you look at the Democrats, they issued a report a couple weeks ago slamming big tech for all sorts of complicated reasons. So there does appear to be broad support for criticism of big tech. So I'm not sure that it's as much of a partisan issue as some of my friends believe. What I will tell you, and I want to say it again, is we are critically dependent as a country on the success of big tech, whether you're an investor, a shareholder, a user. And the other point I want to make is we have a competitor, and it's called China. And the three most valuable companies in China are BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. And they have similar structures in China as we have here, with enormous support from the Chinese government. The competition between China and the United States is the competition to watch. Because if we lose that one, then 50 years of growth are imperiled, right? Whatever happens to Google, have fun, right? But that's not the battle. The battle here is, how does America win with a directed and talented competitor that's focused on winning in the areas that we care about?
Yeah, I definitely want to get to U.S., China, and pick your brain on that and AI. But I'm very curious, and I think many people are very curious, of how you spend your time now. What do you do every day?
Well, I got interested in the COVID problem for obvious reasons. The U.S. national response to COVID will go down in history as one of the most horrific experiences of our government in its 200-year history. The fact that we have a death rate that's five times on a relative basis of our population, the fact that today we do not have a plan to get beyond getting a vaccine out, to get R0 below one, the fact that we have a death rate of on the order of 800 people per day, 60,000 infections per day, with a tough winter coming, with evidence that the winter infections are likely to be high and perhaps not co-linked to the existing flu infections, we don't know. The fact that that we know what the tools are, which include social distancing, mask wearing, avoiding gathering, it's really a horrendous indictment of the government in total. And I think in hindsight, it's pretty straightforward what you should have done. In February, March, we should have sat down and said, what are the 100 things that we're going to do to prevent the spread? Get this, the reproduction rate during that time was roughly 4 or 5. It was incredibly fast. What are the things we have to do to get this reproduction rate and get this thing out of our system to the point where it's just little outbursts? We failed to do that. And instead, we now have community spread. I've been doing the New York State Reopening Commission. We've worked really hard on what the state should do post-COVID. The state, of course, has a great deal of revenue problems because so much of the activity is shut down. The commission has sort of come back, and this will all get announced in the next month or so, with a strong endorsement of universal broadband, a strong endorsement for telehealth, a strong endorsement for retraining as the first three high priority things.
This is your work with the New York Commission?
With Governor Cuomo, who's been one of the good leaders in the country on this. And I was surprised, and I thought I knew a lot about this, how many poor people there are who are really suffering and cannot get access to anything on broadband. they have kids. The kids can't work from home. They can't study from home and so forth. It's a real social disaster. We need to address that very quickly. That's probably, and if you think about it, since we've chosen, if you will, to spend the next year after the last year in this pandemic horror, because we haven't gotten it under control, what we're now forced to do is to live online, things that we could do permanently. I'm very concerned that the damage to children losing 1 year of their education, I just can't imagine the harm to our society by allowing this to happen. And just to finish with my diatribe here, and sorry, a simple strategy of rapid testing, right, where we did rapid testing so we knew how to contain the virus, would have saved tens of thousands of lives. And we've chosen not to do it.
So just to go back to what you're doing, the commission, and I've read a lot on the broadband issue. We've talked about it on this stage over the last couple of days. What are you doing in New York to address that? I mean, if you just use that as a microcosm, what is the solution on that?
Well, it turns out that there are quite a few systems to try to get broadband access to poor people, underserved people, and so forth, which are not being exercised. At the federal and state level, there are quite a few programs for subsidized and free connectivity and also subsidized and free devices for learning. And so those programs are already in place. So much of this is a communications problem and a lobbying problem. The telcos have expressed, at least publicly, their support for our initiatives to try to get to everyone. And we'll see, as the government puts pressure on them, if they really follow through. I hope they will.
Then you also spend some time running Schmidt Futures. How does this all play in there? I mean, is your philanthropic efforts really mostly focused on COVID and solving some of these problems around it?
The real focus of what I'm trying to do with Schmidt Futures is try to focus on science and people. Science, because science is what got all of us, and in particular me, to where we are now. Science is still true. And for anyone who's confused about science, the last time I checked, science was true, as was math and physics. And as much as I would like to deny some of the facts of science, physics, and math, I fail at being correct there. So science matters, and I'm going to fund it. I'm particularly interested in the application of AI to solving science problems. So we call this AI plus X. Virtually all of the hard problems in science are incomputable. That is, there's literally not enough computation in the world to solve them. They're just too hard. But with AI, we can approximate them. The other thing we've been doing, and you mentioned this a bit before, is I'm very interested in the question of talent. We have a series of talent programs. We started looking at postdocs. We created something called the Schmidt Science Fellows for people who are getting a PhD who want to switch into another field, right? So that's sort of the ultimate polymath kind of problem. And most recently, we became interested in 16-year-olds. And the evidence is that 16-year-olds can break out and on the criteria of brilliance, commitment, passion, and sort of integrity, we're going to try to search for the best 16-year-olds in the world. And we'll see if we can find them.
Yeah, on the topic of AI, you are the chairman of the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. To shift back to more of a global perspective or a national perspective, I mean, where are you at now with that commission? And where do you see the biggest focus needing to be?
So the commission was created a year and a half ago, and we have a deadline of this coming March to get our final report. And the question was AI and the national security of the country. And a bipartisan commission within the Congress created us, and we've acted in a bipartisan way. The first question was, how are we doing? And the answer is, we are ahead, but our competitors are a year or two behind. That specifically includes China. And the next question was, what do we need to do about this? And the answer are things which I think you would imagine would be our conclusions. Much more directed funding and basic research, because that's where all this stuff gets invented. There's a lot to invent. We talk about that. Working with allies and partners, building a national research network so that people can have a computational facility to do their AI research and discoveries, and then also working on ethics and making sure that the AI that we build, that we collectively build, reflects American values, that it doesn't have biases that are inconsistent with our cultural values.
And I mean, on the China war, you've been pretty outspoken on some of it. I mean, in your vision, how does this shake out? We just two splintered internets?
I hope not. I think that a splintered internet and the bifurcation of China and the United States is a total disaster. The problem we're having is we don't have the right framing. China is our biggest strategic partner and their biggest strategic competitor. And we can't decide which one we're on. They are critical for buying our crops, monetizing our debt, providing infrastructure that we use every day. Right? That's just true, and it's been a benefit to both countries. But they're also competing in critical areas. And so we have to come up with some language. The language I like is called a rivalry partnership model. We are rivals in some areas and we're partners in others. If you believe that in 15 years that the two countries will be at war together, first, I would build a bomb shelter now if that's true, because it would be a really bad war. But if you believe that, and I do not, but if you believe that, then you would take the position that we should decouple right now. The problem with that set of belief, which I obviously don't agree, is that by decoupling now, you increase the likelihood of a war with a rising power. It's much, much better to stay close to them, to work with them and compete with them while not giving up on our national security and making sure that American companies and technology win. That's why it's a hard issue. But that's at the center of what our foreign policy needs to be.
Do we end up with more of these TikTok situations, or in your view, should we have just come to some sort of compromise around this TikTok situation? Or, I'm talking about TikTok specifically here, but I really mean Chinese apps and American, United States tech-led apps in China.
Well, so there's this, somehow there's this notion that there has to be reciprocity. Well, there's never been reciprocity with China. We were essentially kicked out of China because we're not willing to follow their rules. Their rules are different. I think TikTok is a very good example, because TikTok is a Chinese company where the data is stored in Singapore, and they use Google servers, by the way, to do this, where the concern was that the Chinese government would have access to information about presumably American teenagers, a legitimate concern, I suppose. So the solution is to put that into American cloud-based servers. In this case, through this process, it's ended up being Oracle, but it's still a Chinese company. And in fact, if you look at the deal that's currently under proposal, it's controlled 80% by the Chinese parent. That's probably a reasonable outcome for the level of concern. I don't think of TikTok as a national security surveillance concern, for example. Maybe I'm wrong. By the way, the reason I mentioned TikTok being so precisely is that these concerns that we're expressing about China are exactly the concerns that Europeans have expressed about American firms for 20 years.
I want to ask about 5G, because I'm obsessed with 5G. We led this session coming in with a 5G video. You've said recently that it's basically our lack of 5G is a national emergency. What are the solutions there?
Yeah, millimeter wave is a very high quality, high speed connection for short distances. It doesn't propagate particularly well inside walls. It's very good, for example, in the stadium setting. The fact of the matter is the world knows what the right answer is, which is called mid-band. Both AT&T and T-Mobile are focused now on mid-band frequencies. T-Mobile is thought to be in a very strong position because they got all that 2.5 gigahertz spectrum in the Sprint merger, which is why everybody's so excited about T-Mobile. The long and short of it is that, let me give you the numbers. China this week announced that they had 600,000 5G towers serving 150 million 5G users. That's real 5G, none of this 5GE stuff that is not real 5G. So that is a competitive gap for America with huge implications. How did they get there? They gave 200 megahertz to each of the three telcos with a build-out requirement. We didn't do that. They have a domestic supplier, Huawei, which is subsidized from the Chinese government and built excellent MIMO technologies, which allow it to cover things better. MIMO is the way that antennas work. They're just faster and better than the existing competitors, although they're trying to catch up. We didn't do that. In fact, in the United States, all of those companies left and they moved to Europe and so forth and so on. So the U.S., in addition to not having the right spectrum, did not have the right domestic industry to do this. I am a proponent of sharing spectrum that's also used by the DoD, and there's many announcements about this coming. And the sharing would allow preemption, so the DoD, which is in those bands, would allow it. Sharing is a huge change to our model, but sharing will allow much more use of the spectrum. The problem without sharing, in my opinion, is that the U.S. networks will get built, so thank God they'll get built, but they will be shadows of the speed and capability of what China is doing unless we make a change.
And you're saying so we would be using military airwaves or different types of airwaves, and we would be sharing that along commercial lines. The carriers could use that back end.
Yeah, with preemption for the military and national security use. But the important point here is, independent of my proposal, we've got a national security crisis around 5G. China has a better physical product, a better operational product, and a better financing product around this, which is why everyone's picking up their 5G. What happens if it becomes China? Well, the problem with the 5G infrastructure is it then creates the conditions for all of these other interesting apps, new startups. The whole ecosystem ends up being Chinese and not American. That's a crisis, and it's a big one.
And that gets us back to the question that we had, or conversation we had before, which is about that reciprocity. You seem to have a lot of solutions and answers. And so it makes me wonder, are you planning a run for office?
I've spent so much time in Washington. It's the one place I'm not going to live.
You don't need to live in Washington.
I'm very happy to say no to your kind offer.
Okay. All right. You know, lastly, I want to just ask you to sort of predict out five years in the future, both on big tech. What has changed? What might change in the picture we have today? We'll start there. What do you think looks different? Does it look any different?
Well, I'm assuming that the regulatory processes will continue, and there will be some effect on the big tech companies. But fundamentally, big tech is working because it's providing incredibly valuable services right now globally. And my friends collectively believe that there will be more unicorns, that there will be other big tech. And the reason is that what we now understand is that because of the internet, if you can provide a service that really changes things in the positive direction, you can get scale very quickly. I believed that 5 years ago. I believe it now. I believe it in five years. With respect to the broader questions, a lot of it depends on whether America gets its act together. China has articulated that it wants to win by 2030. In 2025, I'll spare you the details, in AI, energy systems, aviation, financial services, 5G, quantum, so forth, my entire world. So a lot of this will depend, which is why I'm spending so much time on it, whether America can get our act together. We are really, really good when we get focused on this. We have the best universities in the world. The partnerships that we produce between universities and the private sector, often using federal money, I was funded by that when I was at Berkeley, and I'm very, very grateful. I wouldn't be here except for that. We know how to do this. And so I hope whoever becomes president again, I'm obviously a Biden supporter, will strongly focus on a national strategy for excellence in these emerging areas. They are the ones that are going to provide unfair economic advantages to our country, which ultimately produces the wealth, the growth, the stock market, and all of that.
All right. And the last question, 5 years down the line, which of your philanthropic efforts do you hope have come to fruition? You have to name one.
Well, RISE will certainly be a big program, which is the 16-year-old. I have some ideas for things which we haven't done yet, which are even bigger. I'm extremely interested in advancing climate change and various other aspects in physics and in chemistry. It's pretty clear that biology and chemistry are ready for another set of revolutions because of the power of these platforms. And so we'll see how well we do. But that's my focus.
All right. Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough for all your time. Thank you for joining us here at Tech Live.
That's it for today's Tech News Briefing. We have one more conversation to share with you from this week's Tech Live conference in the feed tomorrow. And we have more highlights, including videos from the different sessions, on our website, wsj.com. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.